So I guess we can probably get started. It's a very casual event here, so don't feel nervous, anyone. So just first a bit about the space. This is Daybreak. It's run by New Bloom, which was founded in 2014 after the Sunfire movement. And so we were then student activists, and we made an online publication as a means of connecting Taiwan to the world. And then a few years back, we felt that was not enough, that there should also be physical spaces and places to build community in person. And COVID really showed that. And so that's what this became. And so we are entirely volunteer run. There are a lot of volunteers here today. And so your support is appreciated. And so yeah, we try to create spaces for events like this. And so today we have Joa from Insight Myanmar. So I think the way we can do this is we first just talk a bit, Q&A about Insight Myanmar, and then we open it up as a conversation. Because it seems from what I've gathered, there's a lot of people who actually have experience in Myanmar and would like to share their experiences. So yeah, do you want to start then? Do you want to introduce yourself?
Well, first I'd like to thank Brian, New Bloom, all the wonderful volunteers for making this happen, inviting me while I'm in town to be able to speak about something that I care about very much and that by virtue of people showing up, you care as well. So thank you for that. I'm hesitating on what kind of introduction to give. I have different versions of my introduction, which is now a two-decade relationship with Myanmar in multiple dimensions and layers now that that relationship was formed. And so I think rather than talk at length over different parts of what those interactions are, maybe best to let them come out through questions and conversations. And I really like the idea that this is not just a monologue, not just a dialogue, but something that involves all of us. And so I think all those parts will come out at some point in our conversation together.
Okay, so I guess then maybe I'll take the first question. How did Insight Myanmar start then? Because for example, the website says that started off focused on spirituality, but then moved to other topics after the coup.
Right, so Insight Myanmar started in 2019, and to explain the way that Insight Myanmar started, I have to back up a little bit, so bear with me as I go through some of these stages. I first went to Myanmar in 2003, and I went with an interest in meditation. I was at that time, I was practicing those 10-day intensive meditation Vipassana courses by S.N. Goenka, and the lineage of that tradition is in Burma, so I went with an interest in meditation and very much wanted to go back. It was very difficult at that time to go back under any capacity, given the closed nature of the country. I looked for any number of ways I could go back in any capacity to spend more time in the country and learn more about it. And I was really fortunate to get a chance to go back in 2007 when I was a trainer training English teachers how to teach English. And the training program that I was doing had a relationship with the American Center in Yangon, which was connected to the US Embassy. And so, long story short, I got to go back to the place where I wanted to live, and I got to do my dream job while I was doing it. What started in training English teachers moved very quickly into doing capacity building, civil society, training of trainers courses, and getting into some really exciting things that were happening and the people that were coming to the American Center. This was also Cyclone Nargis, which was really resulted in a real change of understanding of what civil society was and what it could be in Burma with the response to that devastation. And so my first several years in Burma, I was professionally working as a trainer, my background in training, and personally was getting deeper into the meditation and Burmese Buddhism and learning that. So from the very beginning of my time in Burma, I was kind of navigating two very different and sometimes very conflicting and contrasting perspectives and not really knowing where everything fit together. And I think that's what has led the way into the podcast that we've built, is wanting to bring in many different perspectives that sometimes don't exactly align and sometimes seem to contrast. And what is Myanmar if not contrasting and conflicting histories and narratives? And so rather than being one of these old style gatekeeper authorities that are trying to tell you authoritatively tell you the single narrative and the single version of Burmese history, a podcast is the perfect platform to mirror my own background and training, as well as my own experience in coming to Myanmar those early years, of seeing that there are many contrasting realities. We don't have to pick which one is right. We can just open our mind, open our hearts, and see where these come together. After my time training at the American Center, after that position ended after a few years, I went deeper into the meditation. And this trying to shorten this story because a number of serendipitous things happened, which led me to eventually writing a guidebook for meditators coming at that time of the different meditative traditions. That put me in touch with a number of really incredible teachers, practitioners, meditators in the country. And this is what gave birth to the podcast, because I started to find that as I was being informed through their voices in the writing that I was doing, the presentations that I was giving, the media that I was making, I was becoming something of a storyteller for their voices. And I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable that I wasn't getting their voices and their stories and their narratives exactly right. As hard as I was trying, what I was hearing was just so compelling, so beautiful, and moving me so much. I started to think, how can I, instead of taking this knowledge and trying to tell their stories on their behalf or using it for the story that I was telling, how could I instead be a medium and try to leverage the trust that they have in me and the relationship to bring their voices to a wider audience? And that led to Inside Myanmar. Podcast was the perfect platform for being able to bring unadulterated voices to the people around the world that wouldn't have access ordinarily. It started out as a podcast in Buddhism and meditation. And then after the coup, we just simply couldn't talk about the spiritual path or the complexities of Burmese Buddhism or meditation when the monasteries were literally on fire or being used as staging grounds for assaults. And so with the coup, we opened up our mission to be able to talk about beyond Buddhism and meditation, to be able to talk about stories of other religious and ethnic minorities, history, economics, art, LGBT, et cetera, et cetera. So many other things that were brought in along with Buddhism. I mean, I don't see these things as separated by walls or barriers. When you're in Myanmar, these things are all flowing together. And so being able to broaden the mission allowed us to be able to take these stories as they came and let the guests lead the way in how it was being told. So that's my short version of how it was founded.
And now you have 100,000 listens a month. So maybe you could take us through a few of the recent interviews, but I think maybe not everyone has heard the podcast, for example. So like, you know, snapshot of, for example, who you talked to recently.
Sure. Well, one interview I call attention to, this is not so much touching upon the current moment in the revolution, which we can get to, but we recently released an episode that was really, this was a guest that I was driven to have on. I was obsessed, you could say. I called her my Moby Dick. It took years to be able to bring her on, and there were, I've described it. There were moments she was in her 80s, and I knew a lot of her story, but not nearly all of it. And I literally sometimes had pain thinking that she could pass away, and her story would never be known to the world, because her story is one of the most amazing things I've ever heard. Through a series of conversations, she agreed to come on the podcast and tell her story, and we ended up talking for last year. We spoke for a total of 40 hours, which is unheard of for any guest. We barely got to even in that much time, there was so much that we left out. She spoke on the condition that nothing could be released until she passed away. She spoke on the condition that nothing would be released until she passed away. Tragically, that happened a few months ago. We were hoping to have many more years. The first episode of these 40 hours of interviews came out. It's called 12 Years in Burma. Her name was Friedgard Lodermoser. She was a German woman whose father worked for Fritz Werner, the arms manufacturer, and she lived in Burma from 1959 to 1972. This was a period that almost no foreigner, she came when she was 17 years old, stayed until she was 31. Almost no foreigner lived in the country in this time. When trying to describe how remarkable her story is, I've referenced 7 years in Tibet. I say, this is the Burmese version of 7 years in Tibet. And the stories, the circles that she ran and the stories that she told are just things that open up an entirely new world. So this is the first two of 40 hours, and we're really looking forward to starting to put more of those out.
Yeah, and so then that's one example, for example. But for example, I also know you've interviewed regional activists, for example, as it links to Myanmar. For example, not just voices in Myanmar, in the movement, but also, for example, in the region. Do you want to talk a bit about that, maybe?
Like yourself.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. Yes. Right. So yeah, we've I think as our platform has expanded, we've also come to look at what kinds of stories, I don't want to say that we're telling, what kinds of stories are we helping to tell? What kind of platform are we that are able to bring guests and speakers in to be able to tell their stories in ways to help them bring that story out? And so as that has continued to expand, we've looked at, well, what about this group over here? What about this segment? Or what about this population? So as Brian said, yeah, recently in the last few months, we've been looking at Milk Tea and have done interviews with activists, obviously, in Taiwan, also the Philippines and Indonesia, Hong Kong, Vietnam, Cambodia, India, Thailand, etc. And so I think this has been excited to again, you could say, again, we're transitioning and broadening to move beyond telling the stories of what's happening in Myanmar itself and seeing how the stories in Myanmar are reverberating and being relevant to neighboring regions and those voices coming on as well. And that's something that we're doing a lot more of.
Yeah, I'm curious then what you think the challenges are, particularly telling, for example, giving Burmese voices a platform in the world, because we operate under conditions in which, for example, a lot of people are in hiding, they're often in exile or targeting. But then, you know, how do you balance that, for example, with a public platform, which that does have exposure, for example?
I think the best way to answer that is that I've described how our platform, even though it's in the media space and it might be considered media, myself, I don't come from a media background, I come from a training background. And so the principles of training and the methodology of training that I worked on in my professional career before this have led into how I see the podcast conversation. And so when you're looking at media, you're looking at scoops, maybe gotcha moments, maybe something that'll raise the popularity or notoriety of the platform. You're dealing with deadlines. And because of that, sometimes your the importance of the story getting out and getting out at the time it gets out is more important than the relationship you have with the people that the story involves or how it affects the community when it comes out. So, but when you're approaching it as a trainer and have that mindset, the type of training I used to do, we're holding that space as kind of a sacred grounds for to be able to connect, to be able to try to achieve real communication. And because you're trying to do that, there's no real time limit or deadline for when you need to record the interview or when it's going to get released. There's something of a timeless nature for how we try to seek them. You know, to answer your question, the decision to come on and talk is a decision always left to the guests. And you know, their safety is the number one thing. And I always tell guests, the only thing we can't change is your voice. We can change anything else. We cannot give your name, your picture doesn't need to go there. We can not talk about some details of your life. The only thing, because we're an audio medium, the only thing we can't change is your voice. Some of our guests have taken, you know, years to come on. They've taken 2, 3, 4 years to decide to come on our platform. And unless they say no, you're kind of always checking in with them. You know, how are you feeling now? Are there any concerns I can respond to? I'm never trying to push a guest past their comfort level in coming on. And because of that, I think that that gives way to a certain kind of trust. And that trust then opens up the conversation to develop in ways that can be more revealing and more insightful and more vulnerable in those spaces coming. But you know, it's very important that people come in their own time. And so when you're looking at safety concerns and the idea of us being a public platform, just as it's your choice to decide if you want to speak, when you want to speak, how you want to speak, it's also your choice to decide where and when that decision happens. And so as far as this kind of the personal safety of guests, that's a decision entirely left to themselves. And I, you know, the decision to come on is a decision that I want them to feel very comfortable with. And if they have any hesitation, then, you know, we encourage them to pause and come back later for it.
Are there topics you feel have changed that you focus on as time goes on? Because particularly we're a few years after the coup now, for example. And so, for example, even different things that are topical have changed.
I think so, for sure. And I think that there comes to be like a changing, like certain themes that we'll hear more of over, you know, every 6 months. We'll start to realize that, oh, guests are now talking a lot about this. And I think anyone following Myanmar and seeing how these themes have been reported or shared among your friends or stories you're reading, these wouldn't come as surprises. I think in the early stages, of course, this was something that the emotions, the confusion, the hunger for information for what this means and what comes next, that was something that was really animating a lot of our interviews. But as time has gone on and we're now over 3 years into this crisis, I think that the way that people are looking at the developments, the trajectory of how this has gone, and looking towards the future of what could come next, I think there are certain themes that we're finding in more and more of our interviews.
Could you raise a few, for example, recently, let's say the last 6 months, maybe?
Sure. So I think one theme would center around the issue. I mean, this comes as no surprise for anyone, but what, assuming that the military is eventually going to lose out in some form, whether it's legitimacy or funding or just lose enough on the ground, what comes next? I mean, this is the question everyone is talking about. And what are we looking at in a post-military Myanmar? And I think, the obvious next question is, what do I think about it? I would like to quote I can't remember which guest said this, but we had one guest say something like, you know, any expert who tells you that they have a pretty clear idea of what will come next in Myanmar is absolutely lying through their teeth, because none of us have any idea. We've entertained a lot of ideas, we've heard a lot of ideas from, you know, leading experts and democracy leaders and activists and people from ethnic leaders, people from all different areas of spectrum of, you know, historians, people who have institutional history, and we've heard a number of different ideas, some quite pessimistic and some verging towards much more optimistic. But I think at the end of the day, I go back to the guest who said, you know, this is such an unprecedented time, not just in Myanmar history, but to quote the words of Anthony Davis, a military analyst who came on, he described this revolution happening in Myanmar now as something that he could actually not find any historical precedent for the way that this revolution has developed. And so I think by definition, revolutions are unpredictable. It's revolutions of any kind are extremely hard for anyone to predict which way they will go and how they, once a certain storm of the revolution has passed, what will come next. But when you're on top of that, when you're talking about a revolution, in the words of Anthony Davis, that is unique and unprecedented in itself, even compared to other revolutions, then, you know, it's really something we're all trying to figure out.
Hello, Ahmed, and thank you for your sharing. And I just have some simple questions that I'm curious. So first, I'm curious about like how you kind of choose who to be the guest of the podcast. Like, maybe share some. Is there any like criteria or principle regarding probably like ethnic or gender, something like that? And second, I'm also interested in like maybe the impact of the podcast, because you just said that you aim to kind of bring the voices of the Burmese to the world. And did you receive like any interesting comment or feedback from the audience or listener of the podcast? And I'm also curious about what about like the change, or how do Myanmar people think about like the podcast?
Thank you, and please remind me those three questions as I go if I need a prompt. As far as the first question, I think I would break that down into two questions, actually. There's the question of how do we choose the guests that we bring on an interview, and then how do we choose the sequence and order of those episodes coming out? Because we currently have a huge backlog. We have many episodes that have been recorded. We're trying to find a way to release because we've had such a deluge of content and really amazing interviews, which is a good problem to have. In terms of the release of the interviews, I kind of look at it as a dinner that I'm serving to a big meal that I'm serving to my guests and to my listeners. And you need to have your appetizer and your main course and your dessert and your drink and everything. And, you know, I think different interviews to some people represent the meat and potatoes, others represent the vegetables that you have to eat, others represent the ice cream, like, oh, I'm so glad you finally have something of this topic, because we have such a wide range. I mean, we have dedicated meditators and monastics who tune into us and just kind of wait for those episodes that really have the Buddhist focus. Or we have people that are, they want that military analysis. They want the long form analysis of, you know, or whatever else it is. And so we try to have a real diversity of, in the sequencing of episodes coming out, to feel like you're never quite getting the same thing. You're never quite getting comfortable in terms of the information coming in. You know, you might hear from a poet, you know, one week, and then the next episode, suddenly it's a, you know, an ethnic leader, and then an economist, and then a, you know, an engaged Buddhist activist or something. And so, you know, really to hit those different angles. In terms of who we interview, who we choose to interview, it's relevancy is a big factor, diversity is a big factor, stories that we feel aren't being told or haven't really been understood properly to want to, because we're long form and because we have the audience, we're, you know, as I say, we're in the ears of the people we want to be in the ears of. We're in the ears of decision makers, stakeholders, and all other kinds of leaders and activists and journalists. And so, you know, with that responsibility, we know if we can bring in the right guests and prepare and ask them the questions in the right way and get a full answer, we really have the chance of trying to have the right person listen to that and hope that that does something. So that's a factor as well. And then wanting to, looking at, you know, who has a story to tell? Who has a story to tell? That I think one of the great things about a podcast platform, if you do it right, it's decentralized, it's democratized, it's decolonized, and so you're able to have, unlike the, you know, a traditional media where you might have guest columns, and those guest columns are going to noted academics, or, you know, you're not going to have a young grassroots activist who's never published anything suddenly be able to write their thoughts. We can bring those people on. We brought, you know, dozens and dozens of people who've never had this kind of platform to speak and been able to amplify their voice and their story, and, you know, the listener feedback we get of how moved they are, it's really awesome. When the coup first happened, we had a lot of feedback from Burmese that were living outside of the country, thanking us and telling them that listening to our podcast with Burmese who were in the country at that time was giving them a window in a feeling into what it was like to be when they were so homesick and, you know, had some survivor's guilt or didn't quite understand how things were developing. And we had feedback that, you know, they were watching videos and reading news and everything else, but our interviews were able to bring them there like nothing else. And so I think our demographic really grew in that first year of Burmese abroad and feeling like this was a connection that they were able to get at a time when things were changing in such dramatic ways. And other than that, you know, we get, that was feedback that came really consistently, thematically, you could even say. We get feedback with, there'll be episodes that'll come out. Sometimes before they come out, I'll think, this interview is really spectacular. You know, this is really a bombshell. And often we'll have, you know, feedback from that interview. Oh, I can't believe you said this, or this was a great moment. And then other than that, it depends on the episode. And again, because we're so diverse, you know, it's really something to balance everything we're doing with Myanmar, and then, as Brian indicated, expanding broader with Milk Tea and with regional actors, and then the whole meditation component that we have as well. And so the kind of impact we're having in the meditation and monastic world is another thing that we're living with. And, you know, so there will be interviews talking about the lives of great meditation masters or you know, these things aren't separate. Often it's in the interviews itself, we're seeing how these Buddhist principles and Buddhist practice are aligning with some of the stories we're hearing from the revolution. But sometimes the more meditation-oriented stories, we'll get a lot of comments from people that are coming from that world and are hearing things critically about the type of practice they do that they've never heard before, never been talked about publicly. There have been several episodes we've done where we've talked about certain aspects of meditation organizations or teachings or teachers or experiences that, to my knowledge, I've never seen talked about publicly before. And so there's something of even in that field, something of a liberating aspect to see these stories coming out in that way. You know, amazingly, I'd have to check off the top of my head, Myanmar is either the number two or number three country in our demographic. Which is incredible, because you think about we're English language, we're internet problems they have there, we're long form. There are a lot of barriers, and to think that so many in Burma are listening to us, you know, second or third country where we have the most listeners, you know, that just blows me away that there are so many trying to find us and trying to listen to us there, which is, I mean, it's really just humbling. It's humbling to think that. And people have spoken that that have listened, that some of the feedback we've gotten has been the sense of solidarity they feel. Sometimes they feel really down, they feel really, really sad about the way the revolution's going, the loss that's been felt. And by hearing Burmese and foreign voices, it means a lot. By hearing foreign voices, you know, by hearing so many foreign voices who are so dedicated and passionate to doing everything they can to helping the Burmese win this battle and win it in the right way, it's really inspiring. You know, it's really this is the message we've gotten back. It's really inspiring to know we're not alone, like sometimes it feels, you know, that there are these people that we don't know about that are doing these things and holding it in their heart in these ways. And when they hear the Burmese talk, we'll have Burmese guests on that will speak about the enormous sacrifices they've made, the dreams they have for the future, the aspirations and the belief they have of how they're gonna get there, the nonstop dedication they have towards the cause. And to be able to hear that, again, in a person's own voice, unadulterated, you know, coming with the emotion, you know, with the emotion of the vulnerability, going back to this is, you know, some might differ, but to me, this is not journalism. This is training, this is active listening, this is communication. This is a sacred space that we're creating where hopefully guests are choosing to share and to connect in ways they don't outside of that, and connect on a topic that's of supreme importance. And, you know, it's my belief, if you find a way to, and you don't get this every time, but if you're able to create a magic of communication between two people, it can be, as far as my training has gone, and I see this with the podcast conversation as well, it can be transformative, it can be life-changing. To really communicate with someone, you know, deeply communicate, it can literally be life-changing. And, you know, what we try to do is have those experiences and conversations with the other, with the guest, and hope that we're doing it in such a way that we're inviting that third listener, you know, the invisible listener, that they have a seat at the table, you know, and they're being welcomed at that table. And the thing I love the most from listeners, I'll end here, the best feedback I get, and I've gotten this from several people, so it must be something that we're doing that's giving them this indication. People have said, you know, when I finished that interview, I wanted to hug the guest. I just wanted to hug them and tell them it was okay. And to elicit that kind of emotion from a guest that you're hearing in your headphones, that kind of connection, you know, that's beautiful. Other times we'll hear, like, you know, I was arguing with them, I was yelling back, I was saying, why don't you ask them this question? That's great as well. You know, we're not trying to convince anyone of any argument. We're trying to have critical dialogue and conversation, and all of the above is great. You know, arguments, disagreements, tenderness, you know, emotion. All of those things mean that we're breaking through in some way. And when you're breaking through, not just with the emotion or the human connection, but the information, the engagement, the knowledge of what's happening, you know, then hopefully these things can come together to really build something special.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. I don't think this is on. Hello. Yeah. Oh, now it is. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Taipei. My name is James. I'm James Barron. I'm a local journalist, locally based journalist, freelance. You probably know or are aware of the connections or the historical entanglement between Burma and, if not Taiwan, the Republic of China, with the KMT irregulars at the end of the war destabilizing the region, and they took it to the UN, and that's how we ended up with a large ethnic Burmese diaspora in, I'll come to that in a second, actually, that's a second more fun question, in Taipei, and also in Zhongli, I think, in Taoyuan County. But given those connections, not always savory types of connections, do you think that, and also Taiwan's under Tsai and the current administration, the move towards a kind of southbound policy, as they call it, gravitating away from China towards Southeast Asia, do you think Taiwan has some, and also as a beacon of democracy, as they like to say, do you think that Taiwan has some kind of role? There's something that it could do to assist with the situation. There are still many ties. When I visited, there were a lot of people spoke fondly of it, a lot of young people trying to leverage their ethnicity to get over to Taiwan. It's not as easy as it used to be. But it's still, you know, in extant law, there's still unique provisions under ROC law that they don't have refugee law in Taiwan as such, even though they're meant to be in line with UN recommendations on that. But they do have these provisions that relate to ethnic Chinese or people who were meant to be part of the Republic of China in those days that kind of allow for, now it's kind of on a case-by-case basis, but Burmese to seek asylum here. So I'm not maybe specifically talking about the asylum cases because it's hard to say how they're dealing, but do you think Taiwan has some role it can play, not necessarily to address historical grievances, but going forward to assist in some way based on some of the shared history? That's the first one. And the second one's connected. Have you been or are you planning to go to Xiaomiandian, Little Burma, in just out in New Taipei City in Zhonghe? If not, I'd really recommend it. You'll find some nice voices there as well, I think. Thanks.
Thank you so much for those questions. For the first question, I would defer to Brian. Answer that in a moment, but also defer to Brian's podcast where we address that head on. We talk about that in some detail. I'm not an expert in Taiwan or the dynamics here. The way I would like to answer that, however, is not about Taiwan specifically, but about possibilities of what it means for countries in the world who have been through something to look at countries going through something else and the possibilities of that. And I know that in Taiwan there are certain internal dynamics and politics and complexities that are beyond my understanding. But to speak to the potentiality and possibility of that, we had a podcast with longtime Czech ambassador to Burma, Jiří Sittler, I believe his name is, and he was very close to Havel. And he, in this podcast, he described in just beautiful detail how after Havel in Czech Republic was able to win his country's freedom, he felt that we now have a responsibility as a free country to assist any other country going through a similar struggle. And so he had this this deep friendship with Aung San Suu Kyi, and the ambassador speaks about that in great detail on this particular podcast. It's quite remarkable, the level of detail of the communication and relationship they had, and some of the details you'll hear there. And the Czech Republic under, this was after 88, when all these countries were in some kind of transition, the Czech Republic and others were able to make it out, Burma was not, and talk about how the Czech Republic then played a role, and Burma was a very important part in that, of supporting Burmese artists and activists and grassroots leaders and everything else. And so I think that, so when I approached my conversation with Brian, I might have even referenced that on our podcast together, I don't remember, but when I approached the conversation with Brian, not knowing so much about Taiwan or Taiwanese-Burmese relations, that was where I was coming from, was this knowledge of what the Czech Republic had done, knowing something about Taiwan's history, and wondering like, well, geez, this would seem like everything would make sense. But, you know, so also if you don't know much about India and you think, well, hey, this is the world's greatest democracy and we have a democracy movement in Burma, like just a perfect fit. Well, if you know about Indo-Burmese relations, you know that's not what's happening. There's reasons for that. And so that was my background of where I came to the question with Brian. And I think with that, I'll defer to your answer.
I'm actually wondering if you wanted to respond to that.
If we can pivot. Hi, thanks. Welcome to Taiwan. Thank you for your presentation. I want to bring us back to reality. The reality is that atrocities are being committed daily and that the world has abandoned Myanmar. So that's the reality. In that reality, your podcast, which is in English, and we know few people in Myanmar can speak English very well. So I presume you have a really significant audience for people overseas. And I wonder if it's a stated or expressed claim, a purpose of your podcast to actually seek to influence foreign policy towards Myanmar, because the world has abandoned Myanmar. Especially, there's nothing that can be done at the UN because China will block everything in the Security Council, and Antonio Guterres has gone missing on this issue because he differs to China. So firstly, I personally feel there could be that potential if if you're not doing that already. And secondly, maybe a bit of a sort of curveball for you, which is that the Buddhist identity has been co-opted by the military and the NLD, so the liberal quasi-democratic forces and the illiberal military authoritarian regime both have identified Burmese nationalism and used Buddhist nationalism, co-opted that to the exclusion of all other ethnic groups in violent manners. Coming from a Buddhist background, and that's your origin that brought you to Myanmar, have you sought to challenge or break that situation? Have you sought to challenge that establishment? And if so, how have you done that? And have you come up with challenges?
Those are great questions, really great questions. And I would, I'll answer both of them separately, but I would say the connective tissue to those questions is again going to this sacred space that I hold, the art of the communication and the ability to connect and really hear another person. And I think that's, when you're able to do that, I think that this is able to transcend and grow and learn, in whether you're talking about the Buddhist aspect or the or policy. I think to answer your first question, as you asked that, I'm thinking of, like, when I talk to artists, like particularly I was talking to, you know, Bart was not here, a Burmese artist, the name he goes by, and he was different. He was saying, you know, very strongly, I am not an activist artist and I do not want to be an activist artist. And when I had a lot of resistance towards this, and when I was asking him more about it, his answer was that in Bart's growth as an artist, he wanted the transcendence of art to always be highest on the altar above anything else. And if you get that right, then everything else flows. And when you're pushing your activism first, if the art suffers under that activism, it's not gonna have nearly the effect, and that's not the artist he wants to be. I think that's somewhat in the way I look at the podcast conversation, is that if certainly there are values and that we hold and there are outcomes that we like to have, but if that gets subsumed into that promotion, then we're gonna lose some credibility, it's gonna change the nature of the conversations. That kind of agenda or tone of like, but don't you think that, you know, that kind of vibe starts to creep in, and then we lose the quality to be able to have, you know, that the raw honesty, vulnerability, openness that we aim for, that starts to get compromised as soon as you hear something, you know, but don't you think that, isn't it kind of like, you know, that's an indication I better watch myself, or I better be defensive, or I better be careful about the words that I'm constructing, rather than wanting to get deeper and deeper into who they are, what their story is, what their experiences they have to tell us. And so very much I hope that, and I've heard, actually, I can give you several examples of how I've heard our podcast referenced in various briefings and policy discussions of all kinds. I know it's already happening, it's been happening for years, and it's awesome, it's great. I hope it happens more. You know, the fact that the more I hear about that happening, the more responsibility it gives me to think about what kinds of guests can we have on, how can we prepare for them, you know, read their papers, go through their stuff, how can we make the conversation engaging, you know, so it's not just dry, technical, you know, data that people have to struggle to listen to, but the kind of stuff that, you know, the driveway moments, or, you know, you're on your driveway and you don't get out of your car because you just want to keep listening. So how can we drive the conversation with more important guests, more important topics, and more engaging, and it is for everyone to listen to, of all stripes. Those are definitely values, but they're values that always, the primacy of the value of the conversation has to be at the center of that. It has to be at the center of, you know, so if I go into a conversation thinking, like, if my motivation in that conversation is I want to get this data out of this person and have it resonate with these listeners in this way, if that's the drive that I have, it won't be effective. And I can say I did that once. It wasn't about policy, it was about meditation. I went in with someone with an axe to grind, and I wanted to get a certain kind of answer and push it in a certain kind of way. It's not an interview I'm proud of. You know, I knew I had that energy before I went in, and I could hear it in my voice after I came out, because I wasn't going in with that respect and that honesty and that openness to have him tell his story. And so with policy, with that, you know, the more authentic we are in how we're able to navigate these conversations, the more detailed we are in the data that we prepare for and get out, the more compelling it becomes. Yes, that can be an end result, but the process means everything. And if we decide, you know, someone one time said, "Oh yeah, that's the podcast that used to be Buddhist and now it's activist," and I kind of recoiled a little bit because, like Bart, I don't see us as an activist podcast. That changes the way I would look at doing an interview. That doesn't mean I want to have the same result you're talking about in spades, you know, very much so. But I don't want to approach it by saying I'm having an activist conversation, because then you're not fully going to trust the conversation when you start tuning in, because you're like, okay, what's their angle here? What's their agenda here? And our angle is guest-driven. At the end of the day, we are guest-driven, and we want the guests to be able to drive their content out, with us being able to drive, know how to navigate, drive the car, bring the best out of them. In answering your second question, I'd like to start with about Buddhism by telling a story that kind of shows the challenges of the journey that I've had to go on. When I first came to Burma, one of the things that really struck me and gave me that sense of devotion and reverence and dedication to the practice I was doing was seeing a pagoda on the top of a hill. And going to that pagoda, it was always well-maintained, clean. I could meditate there. This was a time, and meditation is so common now, but this was a time where I was a weirdo for doing meditation in my country. Here, I could go to a pagoda on a beautiful hill with the wind blowing through, nice sounds, well-maintained, free. Sit down for an hour, you know, finish, bow down to the statue. Everyone around me is smiling. This was kind of like my introduction, and the warm embrace I had, you know, going into Buddhist Burma, and was something that, you know, being able to see those pagodas on the hill and to go there and practice, it was something that really endeared me to the country. Well, I was talking to a Chin friend, this many years later, She talked about the Burmese military going into Chin villages, tearing down crosses, tearing down churches, forcing the Chin Christians to build pagodas on the hill. And so I'm like, when I hear this, I'm like, how am I supposed to hold that? How am I supposed to look at a pagoda and feel the same, you know, authentic sense of connection and reverence and, you know, spirituality that it was giving me, when I know that some pagodas, not all, but some pagodas are being built in this way? And it also gave me like this passion and this drive to want to educate other meditators like me, you know, that would go in blindly like I did and just, oh, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this wonderful? Well, I don't want to rain on your parade. It's great to be able to connect like that, but you can't close your eyes to how some of these pagodas are getting built. And so then that becomes a challenging thing to navigate. Is it possible to keep your faith and your appreciation on this spiritual path while also knowing the injustices that have occurred in the name of this faith, and that sometimes, you know, in a pagoda on a hill in a rural place are coexisting in a single physical structure? You know, that's a really hard thing to be able to know how to hold. But again, what is Burma if not contrasting narratives and conflicting stories? And is there a way we can hold both of these together and not lose one, not sacrifice one to say the other one is more true? With that in mind, I think that's how we've tried to navigate the discussion of Buddhism in our conversations. And, you know, we've had podcasts where we've talked about how the military has used and abused and manipulated Buddhism, how they're destroying the faith of the younger generations by saying it's something it's not, the numerology, the materialism, the astrology, you know, everything else, obviously the violence. You know, we've had episodes on Sidigu Sayada and Tabawa Sayada and kind of what's going on with them. We've had many, many conversations with Burmese Buddhist monks, meditators, nuns, democracy leaders who have a Buddhist practice, and kind of the flip side of how the military is destroying Buddhism, we've talked about how Buddhism aligns with values of human rights and democracy, and how it's, you know, in the case of some monks, how they see the Buddhist teachings as being an inspiration for being a multi-ethnic, multi-religious federal democracy that encourages you know, education and opportunity and everything else that goes along with it. So I think in terms of like how we've tried to bring Buddhism to the platform, it's not one thing, it's complex, it's driven by the guests, but also responded to by my you know, 20 years of experience in how I've identified with having a Buddhist practice and navigated the challenges that have gone with that. And through all of that, you know, and not being one thing, not having an agenda, not trying to be an authority on it, but wanting to speak the truth, you know. And if Buddhism is about, if Buddhism is about anything, it's about truth. It's about, to me at least, it's about speaking the truth, saying this much I know is true. And so if we can have conversations with all these variety of guests, and if we're able to get to a place where we can say, this much I know is true, this much I know is true, if we can say that, then I think that's something that we're all learning together. And, you know, and it's, but it's challenging, but it's a challenge I embrace of how can we tell this story with warts and all and not leave that out and be truthful and honest with it, but how can we also, where there are places of true in myself or particularly with the guests, where there's a you know, reverence, there's spiritual growth, there's humility, can we also have a place for that? Because so often in media, in traditional media, I see the latter left out, and so how can we bring all of these in according to who our guest is? How are we able to bring in all these different facets of what it means to be a Buddhist or a meditator or have a spiritual practice? Or, you know, and when it comes to spiritual practice, it's not just Buddhist, obviously. We've had people on that have, you know, Christian and Hindu and Muslim, even Waitsa. And we've asked them the same questions. How has your spirituality, how is your spiritual teacher, how has it informed what you're doing? How has your Christian faith informed what you're doing? Or how is your, in a conversation we had a couple weeks ago, how is your Waitsa, you know, your 30 years of Waitsa study, how has that informed your relationship with Burma? And so it's the same question we ask everyone. We just, Burma being a majority Buddhist country and myself coming from that background, we might ask it a little more when it comes to Buddhism, but it's a question that interests me about whatever the background is of the guests. So does that answer it?
Yeah. Two questions to ask for you. All of you who want to do predictions, I understand, but what was very interesting the first year of the revolution was that very soon there were lots of discussion of trying to build an alternative system of governance. So the NUG is the most visible part, but there was the CRPH, who were the elected MPs of 2020. And then there was the NUCC, who was supposed to be the National Unity Consultative Council, who was in charge of writing a new constitution, which was supposed to be multi-ethnic and federal. And I was wondering if there are still talks, because then I kind of lost track. I mean, it was chapter one, then it got complicated. And so I was wondering if this thing was still on, if your guests still bring it up, or if this idea of a federal coming, this space of building the new constitution has fallen for many reasons, because of course the war has gone worse. It might not be only because people disagree, but because of the reality of what happened. And my second question is more specifically about Arakan. Have you had guests from the Arakan army or who are in Arakan? And because I'm quite familiar with Kachin, Kuren, Shan, that's okay, but Arakan has been somewhere I've never been, and I've always read through, but I never talked to anyone from Arakan, so I'm kind of interested in what other perspective from Arakanese you heard on your show.
So first question, we have, This piggybacks on the question Brian asked a little bit ago. This is an answer I would have given if I had thought of it at the time. What themes are you hearing more about now? And one of those themes would be local governance. And from the ground up, not the big initiatives from the top, but small things that are working and building on those to create a momentum. That is something we're hearing a lot more of. We were hearing a lot more at the beginning of kind of the big initiatives and the big hope and the big optimism, and we're hearing much more. And so to answer your question, we're, you know, I in those first couple of years, we did have guests that talked in a lot of detail about the NUCC and CRPH and NUG. We're not hearing that so much anymore. We're hearing where the conversation is going more naturally is looking at those ground initiatives. And, you know, like the interview we did recently with Saul Cappy and what he's doing in Karen and Kareni, that's, you know, like just primary territory in terms of that, of looking at that. But we've had a number of guests on. This is also where it becomes challenging, the question that we had of the safety and the public knowledge of what's said. We, and Saul Cappy also had these reflections as he was determining whether or not to come on our podcast, is kind of weighing to what degree is it good to correct the record and describe some really good things that are going on, like things that people don't know about or aren't talking about enough, or naysayers are being too critical or talking about how this is a civil war and, you know, everything's breaking down and there's not good news coming. To what degree should I engage on this platform by telling really stories of something that is like really being built and really being built the right way and really like changing local communities in a way, again, unprecedented, in ways that have never been seen before, to give this sense of hope and optimism of what we're building and what we're doing and what we're seeing, not as theory, but what is actually happening, and that we can have, that we can feel good about. And to what degree do I want to stay silent? Because maybe these things need to keep happening in silence, and maybe they need to happen. You know, how many times have people come to me and said, oh man, the things that I can tell you, but I can't say them publicly. And then when they say that, you know, have that conversation with them. I tell them, well, here's the dynamic. You know, you talk in public. If there, you don't have to talk about everything, but if there are a few things you can talk about in public, and there's a value to people hearing that your knowledge, and as someone like me who believes, like, I think that, you know, communication is the highest god I put on the altar. So if your voice can be that communication that can influence people in that right way, who knows what could happen? But you have to be the judge of what you feel comfortable and safe and want to get out to the world. Maybe keep this, you know, separately, and maybe this part you can share. And so we have had more of those conversations, more people sharing, more conversations behind the scenes of, you know, this thing you're working on and talking about. Do you think it's the time? Do you think you could talk about this aspect of it? And that's coming more and more. So we are hearing more about the small things, small but significant things that are happening at the local level and that are being built up. And I think the thing about Saul Cappy's interview that really struck with me was, you know, what he was doing really seemed to me kind of a response or a reaction to the large-scale initiatives. And that's what gave me a lot of confidence in hearing him, because I was thinking, this is like Burmese history, is that, you know, what top-down mandates are we leaders, we elite, going to say this is what's going to work and this is how it's going to work? And, you know, this is, going back to Peng Long or something, you know, of like this, this kind of leader-led movement or structure. And so to see examples of things that are happening at the other end of that, I think is really inspiring and really awesome to see. And I think it's in some ways it's natural, and in other ways, you know, it's so innovative, it's so courageous, and really responding to the moment by looking at how you can make those smaller changes and have the smaller changes build into something where you're suddenly starting to spread in ways that, you know, the top-down people are still trying to figure out exactly what word to put here, what to, what buy-in to have there. And I've heard a lot more success from those bottom-down ones. You know, I've heard from from the top-down, I've heard a lot of frustrations, a lot of things being stagnated, and, how many hours a day of Zoom meetings that, you know, who likes that? Where does that go? To answer your next question about Rakhine, before I answer this specifically, I would say, as I mentioned, kind of the growing or expansive audience that we're, guest list that we're trying to have to bring in those voices, I would say the one area that we really have to work on, you know, really honestly speaking, transparently, that we've not had enough voices on, and for obvious reasons, it's hard to get those voices, but it's the most important to our ethnic leaders, you know. And I often think if you know, the kind of platform, the kind of conversations that we have to be able to hold differences, contrasting stories, et cetera, if we can start moving in a direction where we are able to speak to ethnic leaders, you know, and we have spoken to some that I can point to that have really articulated in somewhat controversial ways, I would say, what they want for their people and their distrust and their the direction they want to move in. The episode that just came out yesterday is one of those. It's a Rohingya leader. And already we've had comments in social media that are shooting down what he says. I'm not defending what he says. I'm defending his right to say it. He absolutely, positively has every right to articulate what he wants for his Rohingya people and what he doesn't want, even if those opinions are controversial. And we need to hear that, and we need to respect that, and I think we all win by knowing that. And I think the more that our platform in particular are able to find those English-speaking ethnic leaders who can articulate the story of their people, their movement, what they want, what their concerns are, and you know, being in the ears of who we're already in, I think those are incredibly valuable things to hear. And so that's definitely a direction that we've been trying to, in our own way, not moving so fast that we break things, but in our own careful way of wanting to welcome more and more of those voices. When it comes to Rakhine specifically, we have not had anyone from the AA speak directly on. We have had Rakhine scholars, Charles San Ling, I think his name is, or I think I'm getting that wrong, but I can refer the episode to you. He's a longtime scholar of Rakhine politics and conflict, has come on. We've had other analysts come on and talk about Rakhine. And we have had a couple of episodes that have focused with Nathan Rooser, who's a satellite expert, has talked about that in some depth. So we have had episodes that have focused somewhat on Rakhine or exclusively on Rakhine in a couple of cases, but we have not had people from AA as we've not had people from many of the other ethnic organizations. That's something that we're trying to move to bringing more on.
But even Rakhine and Jew Rakhine people.
We've had Rakhine people, yeah. The scholar I'm mentioning, whose name I just butchered, I'm conflating him with another name. We had Rachatu. Rachatu is a pretty well-known journalist. He came on some time ago. He was actually the one who broke the story of the beheadings. He happened to be there when that was happening, and he talked on the podcast about that in the kind of behind the scenes of how he got that story. So we had that on some years ago, yeah. And I would also add that Murat Chatu also spoke in quite a bit of length about the anti-Rakhine racism that he experienced during the transition period from Bwar people. That was a very interesting part of that interview, and why he spoke. And we had another guest who echoed this, that I have to remember who it was, that spoke to why Rakhine wasn't as involved with CDM and in the early days of supporting the revolution, that kind of breaking down and explaining that that anti-Rakhine racism they experienced, as well as the internet blackouts. And we had an episode on that was just a few weeks ago that was not about Rakhine, but it was about the internet blackouts that the regime has used in certain areas, and talking about how, you know, the Rakhine blackout, I can't remember what year it was, but the Rakhine blackout that occurred, that where there just wasn't any internet, that's like, I think that's the, that holds some world record for, you know, the number of days that the internet was just shut down during that period.
Yeah. Thank you for coming, and I've actually never heard of your podcast until today, but I'll definitely go home and check it out. So I actually lived in Burma from 2003 to 2008 as a kid. I have a friend who still lives there. So, you know, like the coup happened, and then there was COVID, and obviously the government wasn't doing anything. And like, I kind of stopped following the news at some point. But I think you might have answered this question earlier, but what gives you hope?
Well, what gives me hope is just the this is not an original answer, but the resilience of the people. You know, like, what they're doing, this is gonna be studied, this should be studied in history books for the rest of our lives, like what they're doing. You know, we've never seen anything like this. And Anthony Davis gave that kind of bird's eye view of this revolution being without precedent for several reasons, but it also seems, you know, I think about like, if this were to happen in other countries in the world, the military doing what it did to take the kind of control it did and to be as vicious and brutal and commit the kind of atrocities that it does, in what other countries would you have a young generation and people overall that are putting everything on the line day after day the way that we're seeing there? And that's what makes me do what I do. You know, that's like, I am following in the footsteps and the energy of what the Burmese are leading. You know, this is, I would not be motivated to tell these stories or be involved, you know, day after day after day since February 1st, 2021, if not for all of my friends and people I care about and people that have come to be friends and come to hear their stories, and to just know like how hard they're working for it. And I want to say how hard they're sacrificing, but you know, one time I told a friend, I said, I have a friend who's in Yangon now, and he's, you know, he's risking his life and everything he's doing. And it's incredible because he's, he could leave, he has a visa, he has opportunities abroad. And he told me, I'm gonna leave when we win the revolution. I don't wanna live in Burma. I don't wanna live here later in my life. But I can't leave while this is going on. So I'm gonna stay through the most dangerous and worst part of the experience just to help my country win freedom. And then once we do, then I'm gonna go start a life somewhere else. And I just like blows your mind hearing something like this, you know, that he's working for a future that he isn't certain he's gonna be there for, but he nonetheless wants to stay while that future is being won. And when I said to him something about how moved I was by his sacrifice, he corrected me. He said, I really angers me when people say the word sacrifice. So I have to catch myself in saying that. Because he said, I'm not doing, a sacrifice is when you're giving something up, when you're losing something, when you're letting go of something because you want to do something else. I said, well, isn't that what you're doing? I mean, you're letting go of, well, you're possibly letting go of, you know, safety of your life, you know, rest or your very life by what you're doing. You know, you're in harm's way. And you're also sacrificing, you know, money, opportunity, job, career, everything you could be doing somewhere else, safety. And so how do you see this as not a sacrifice? And, you know, he was very adamant that, like, no, I'm not sacrificing. My friends are not sacrificing. We are, this is a conscious choice. We're doing it with agency. We're doing it with happiness. We're doing it with joy. That and we are not going to stop. And so, you know, hearing that from just so many people, we're not going to stop, and we're not going to accept this, and we don't know what's going to come next, and you know, it can't be overly optimistic that that everything's going to work out the way that we want. But for the time being, for the present moment, as much as I would like to use the word sacrifice to kind of remember that advice from my friend, to answer that question about optimism, you know, I've never heard of so many people trying so hard for so long when the odds were so much against them. And that the momentum is, it's now clearly in their favor, like the military is losing. You know, every interview we do, we don't get pessimism from guests on the military hanging on to power. We talk to so many people with such amount of knowledge from so many different directions. And the most pessimistic thing they say is, I don't think they're gonna be gone in a year or two. I think it's gonna take a little longer. I think it's gonna be a little bloodier. No one has really said, no one has really made a case for the military truly holding on to power. The pessimism that's come is in the post-military reality. That's another thing to talk about. But to look at like what they were faced with in those early terrible dark days after the coup and where we're at now, and that all happening, you know, as it's been just left to the side. It's not getting media attention. It's not getting aid money. It's not getting hopes and prayers. It's not even getting hopes and prayers. You know, it's not even getting flag decals on. I mean, can we at least get a flag decal that, like, you know, Ukraine or Gaza or other places that you just see the flag and just remember the flag means something? Like, we don't get any of that. And And yet, even without that, you know, nothing from the UN, nothing from RTP, nothing from ASEAN, nothing from the neighbors, nothing from the Western countries that seem to hold these values and, you know, that seem to be promoting these values. And then with our recent election in my country, we'll probably be getting, you know, more heaps of nothing, if we can even hope for that. And yet, despite all of this, you know, the Burmese people have said, after they realized, okay, R2P is not coming, this other stuff's not there, we'll just do it on our own. And that's what they did. And like, have we ever seen anything like this in human history that I know of? You know, maybe there's some precedent, I don't know of any, that really fits this. And so if we could have a platform that are talking to the actors that are doing this, trust us enough to come on and tell us how they're doing this while keeping themselves safe and their work safe, and hopefully that's, you know, that's going to places where, you know, it's going to policymakers and decision makers and stakeholders, where they could hear that, as well as just the average person around the world, you know, who's just listening while they're working out, while they're driving, while they're cooking, and just feeling some sense of solidarity, some sense of not of pity, not of hopelessness, but some sense of power, that this is, you know, this is happening and this is something to care about. And so, you know, I think that as far as winning the first part of the revolution, I think that the spirit that we've heard, that I'm sure you've heard from your friends, that we hear on so many of our episodes on the podcast, this is, you know, if this doesn't give you hope, and again, it's a different hope for rebuilding. It's a different hope for rebuilding. I get that. But for the hope of resisting and of continuing to resist and to go past this military, that's something that they're proving every analyst out there who said something different at the time the military took power. So that's a lot.
So I was a journalist, I think I still am a journalist, and I also worked for an NGO as a trainer of trainers. So my personal opinion, no offense, I think you are doing journalism. It's just very particular, very personal kind of journalism, and I applaud that, because I think traditional forms of media are having a hard time adapting to our current times, and what you're doing is really important. Which brings me to another technical question. So how was it at the beginning of this podcast, when maybe you switched the focus from spirituality to for lack of a better description, current affairs in Myanmar? Did it take a long time to get your to get new audience, or to get your current, your existing audience accustomed to the new format? How was that? And how are you sustaining the podcast, through advertisement or subscription? Or how you, is it as I say, self-sustainable, or do you have some other projects?
Yeah, so when we first switched over, I think my biggest concern was just, am I capable of this? You know, am I able to navigate conversations on so many varieties of topics that I don't necessarily have the background in? And like anything, it was a learning experience, and it didn't happen all at once. You know, every kind of new achievement or level that happened was something to celebrate. You know, I remember the first time we talked to a bona fide scholar, and it was like, wow, I held my own with read the book and had the questions prepared, and was able to, you know, didn't come off sounding stupid, was able to have an intelligent conversation with a scholar. That was kind of one mark. And you know, the first time we had a celebrity or an artist or a democratic leader, you know, there's always that little bit of nervous excitement, and also like, am I really capable of this? And when you're able to get through it, then, oh yeah, I am. And we get the feedback, it's, realize, okay, there's something here. I don't need to be a scholar to have an intelligent conversation with a scholar. I don't need to be an artist to have a genuine conversation with an artist, and so on. And once I realize that, I do need to be informed. I do need to know their work and be able to comment intelligibly on and ask questions and follow up on those questions. But I don't need to know everything about everything. And that was kind of the illusion I was under when I started. I think also, like, just the as I've said again, we've cycled through different types of guests, and it's exciting to me to keep realizing, oh, this is a segment I never thought of before. We could talk to them. I've never thought of talking to Milk Tea. You know, I didn't know anyone from Milk Tea. And then suddenly we did. And then suddenly we knew a lot of people. And now suddenly we're telling stories of Milk Tea and we're connecting them. We're like, oh, what you said, that reminds me of what I heard from Vietnam or Indonesia or something. And then, you know, that gets more exciting. When we first made the change, at one point I realized we had a run of episodes that followed a similar trajectory. The immediate months after the coup, because this was so new to us, it was kind of like a young Bamar activist from an urban area who had a holy shit moment where they suddenly realized what was happening and they had to respond to it. I mean, and you could see why we had so many of these stories. These are incredible stories and they bring the listener in. But I suddenly realized, like, oh, we're kind of running through the same trajectory on every interview. And so I started to think, well, there's more to Burma than this. How are we going to change this up? And that's where, you know, we talked to like Dave LaDuke and Dave Eubank and I think a couple of scholars came on. We had an amazing interview. One of the biggest, the most listened to ones we did was the American monk who ordained under Siddhi Guseyada and was his biographer for a book that never came out. It was very truth-telling conversation, that episode. And so we just kind of, from there, just kind of grew in different ways. And I think I was... The meditator audience that was with us already, because by that point we just had an audience of meditators, Buddhists, and practitioners. There were some people that I think were less interested in the politics and made that known. There were some that felt this was kind of the ugly business of the world that your podcast had been really good at avoiding, and now you're getting messy, and why would you do that? But actually, I thought I was being more authentic because, like, there are no walls. These walls don't exist in Burma. You know, the walls between politics and spiritual striving and monasticism and all this other stuff. It's when you're there, it's all flowing. It's the foreigners who come and say, well, we're interested in human rights. We're not interested in meditation. And it's okay. Well, you have a human rights activist who's a serious meditator, and he's not going to talk about meditation. He's only going to talk about human rights. And so, you know, the human rights experts, they miss this part of the story because they minimize it and they don't give it importance. And, you know, so we're not trying to conflate things that don't go together. We're just trying to be interested in the whole parts of people that are coming to us. If someone doesn't have a background in meditation, we don't talk about it. But so that was one part of it, you know. But a number of meditators were really appreciative. And they were like, you know, I've always practiced my meditation in a vacuum. And you're making me realize how, like, it's part of something greater. And I have something to give back. And that it comes from part of the world that is more complex than I realized. And the more I learn about this, it actually deepens my meditation because it's not just this, you know, Orientalist thing that I picked up and that's for me, but it's actually a connection with a people. But also it makes me realize how I need to be involved. I need to care about what's happening there. That was wonderful. But, you know, like I say, it's funny because we have listeners who say, politics stuff doesn't really interest me. I just wait till I get those meditation episodes and God, I love those. But then we have people who say, like, you know, oh, the military analysis and, you know, interviews with the Democratic leaders are great. And then you just throw a meditation interview in there. It's like, well, where's this coming from? So, you know, but my real goal is that people who come, who join us for the journey, wherever they come along, whether they're a foodie or an artist or a meditator or a diplomat, whatever it is, they realize that everything's connected. And they might come for the foodie episodes, but then they stay for the meditation episodes. Or they might come to listen to a deep dive into human rights or sanctions, but then they stay to listen to the artist or something. And that they see where all this fits together. In answer to your second question, you know, this is something that we're dealing with now because really what's happened is the momentum of what we've built, of our platform, both in terms of the listeners that are now coming to us unsolicited, unprompted sometimes. Before we had to like go out and give people our bona fides and convince them that we were worth talking to, that we were trustworthy. We've been around long enough that we now have people coming to us asking if they can speak on our platform, and which is, it's a great honor. It's, you know, it's humbling. Other times we have people that we want to speak to and don't quite know how to approach them. When we do, they've already heard, and when we approach them, you know, I have to explain what we do and kind of hope they'll have time for it. They're such a busy or important person. There's been several times that's happened, and they said, oh yeah, I've listened to your voice for 2 years. Like, of course I'll do it. It's so humbling to have that reputation, you know, and to have people trust us from before the word go. But what that's done in terms of like an organizational structure is that the momentum of what we've built in terms of the audience that we've built up, the impact that I hope we're having, and the guests that are trusting us with their story, means that that has all happened at a pace that's outstripped our organizational capacity to manage it. And that's what we're working on now. We are, as with New Bloom, a lot of volunteers, a lot of people taking small stipends, and that's not sustainable for the level of impact we're now trying to have and that we see that we can have, and for the guests whose stories we can put there in a way that will really make a difference to those people listening. And so we're trying membership models. We're doing different fundraising things. We have a new membership model in place that a project manager that was brought in is helping, much to her chagrin. I told her, look, the line in the sand is that I will never have a paywall over the content we produce. And she's like, well, what are we supposed to do when your most valuable asset is the thing that you're never gonna wall off? It's like, no, we're trying, like our point, we wanna have an impact. We wanna raise those numbers and make a difference. So yeah, you're gonna have to think of other clever ways to have a membership where we're, you know, the most valuable thing we're always gonna give away for free. That goes without saying. And we're doing fundraisers, you know, and we're hoping to do like every other month to do some kind of, you know, we're looking at a mental health fundraiser, a fundraiser involving meditation, some involving art, more with food and cooking. But this is our way to try to reach out to our listeners and show them that if they're benefiting from the content that's coming, this is a way to support our overall mission and try to keep us alive. But yeah, that's you know, trying to find a way to be sustainable and maintain the momentum that we've built to this point is something we're trying to do. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
All right, so maybe give Joanne.